we just got done visiting Mini-Me. And I say that because that's when he sent me the email, that's how he signed it. Mini-You, he said.
He's 3 inches shorter, but still.
He's only like 6'4" or something like that.
Oh, that's right, 6 feet.
Yeah, he's a little tiny fella. He's a wee little mon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but anyway, he's Mr. Tough Construction Guy. But he says he's got himself 5 acres. He's done some amazing things on the 5 acres, building a home and whatnot. And now, apparently, they got 5 head of cattle on their 5 acres. Even though they're 5 acres, their land is sad.
Yeah.
It's like a really gravelly soil. Anything that's growing there, it's sparse. And so he came to Missoula to pick up a horse trailer, which he'll use to haul cattle.
Right. They've been able to find cattle for really, really pennies on the dollar compared to normal prices on Craigslist and different places. They're picking up real cheap cattle that they want to raise and sell and start making some money on the side by doing that, but they needed something to haul them in besides a dump trailer that they had. So they
needed something that was lower to the ground that the animals could get in and out of a lot easier. And they said that they bought a calf at one point, and they ended up strapping the calf to the side of the trailer because it was like not, well, anyway, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but straps were involved, and I kind of really didn't want to hear anymore.
Right.
That was getting a little nutty. But on the other hand, since he was in Missoula, we shared a meal. He's really interested. He came out on my farm when I had the 80 acres and did a bunch of work out there. And he is an artisan with wood and with construction. Yeah, it's amazing what he can do in just a blink of an eye. So now he's like remembering a lot of that. And he thought that a lot of my strategies were really good. So he's asking like, okay, how do I go about doing this permaculture-like stuff? And he's saying, you know, he's not really bought into the whole organic idea, but he's open to the idea of buying into it for the sake of, you know, making more money and everything. And I'm thinking, well, okay, if that's going to be your motivator, I think we can do that. And I tried to explain it, and I didn't feel like I was making good progress.
I think he was getting it. The land is so poor right now. There's not a lot of graze or browse, so they need to bring in hay and feed. And he was checking with you on good organic feed sources, so he's looking at that and trying to figure out how he can get the best price for what he's doing, how he can turn a profit and not just reimburse for the feed. He wants to be able to pay for his feed and then pay for the feed for the next one at the very least.
Right, right. And so far it seems like, you know, the business model he's looking for is like he wants to, you know, which is, I think I hear from most people that I talk to, it's like, how can I supply food to people for a price lower than they can get it at Safeway? And then permaculture people are also in the space of like, okay, I want to do that, and I want it to be permaculture awesome food, but for a price lower than Safeway.
Yeah, but that's what they mentioned in that movie Ingredients that we just did a podcast on, is the big agriculture farmers, they were losing money. They were losing their farms, literally, by trying to grow commodity goods. And anytime you're trying to compete with the big CAFOs, in this case, you know, the bad way they grow the beef, anytime you're trying to compete with the huge high production growers, you can't reduce your overhead enough and you can't get your feed cheap enough to compete with them. So I think what you need to do is provide a different product. You're providing a local product. You're providing a lot of times a healthier product, a more humane product, you know, all of those things that a lot of people are looking for and willing to pay for in their food.
Right, and I think, you know, I think there's a variety of markets, and so, you know, as we start traveling this path, I mean, like the thing I did with Hogs out of Mount Spokane, I mean, I was just shocked to the core how good of a market I built and how fast Hogs. In fact, we talked to that guy, did I mention that when we talked to that guy with the sausages?
You talked to him, I left.
So the guy with the sausage, right, he said some mild things. He was a salty dog. So, but basically he's like, hey, you know what? I'll carry organic sausages and, you know, I'm fully prepared to pay higher price, but I need 500 pounds of shoulder each week. And so I just need somebody in Montana to provide that for me. And there just really isn't anybody. And so I think he's got a good point there. And so it's like, well, you know, my brother, Tim, could be that provider. He's a little farther away, but it's possible. It could work out. I think that there are markets where there are people who insist upon organic, and a lot of it was like the Hogs that I had on my book, and there are people that loved their bacon. And I mean, they're like 60, 65 years old, and it's like bacon is their life, and they've only got a few more years to go, and the idea of having 10 more years of life without any bacon is a life not worth living, you know? And I can understand that. But if they eat anything from Safeway or even some of the organic places, then it's time to visit the hospital. I mean, they had that much sensitivity to it.
Right. Well, and I worked with someone, too. Her family, a couple of her family members, if they bought conventional chicken, they would get sick. But if they bought organic chicken, they would not. So, and you know, their food prices were going through the roof. So, yeah. Anyway, I think there's definitely a market for it.
I think that there's going to be, and then on top of that, and he's talking about, oh, the economy is low now, and this is what the economy looks like where we live, and so there's no way. And I'm saying, okay, you know what? We could go and drive through some neighborhoods, and we're going to see some houses that easily cost $5 to $10 million per house. Those people, you know, most of those people have so much money in the bank that the idea of pork being $20 a pound instead of $2 a pound means nothing to them. You know, they don't even want to hear you prattle about the price. You know, talking about money is for little people.
Well,
so they've got so much. So it's like that is a market.
That is a market, but that doesn't have to be the only market. I mean, there's plenty of people, and I'm one of them. I would rather spend more on my meat and my vegetables and all my food to get the cleanest, healthiest food than, you know, I'm not going to go out and buy a bunch of, you know, new pillows for my couch. I'd rather have really good food. And so I'm happy to spend more for that than spend my discretionary income for, you know, beers at the local pub or pillows for my couch or other things like that are discretionary income. So, and I'm not in the top percent income-wise, that's for sure.
So, I think that there are a variety of markets, but rather than trying to find the lowest possible market or being focused on the lowest possible market, I think it's totally legit to focus on a much higher market. And part of what he was doing was thinking there are a lot of farmers that are just like, you know what, I'm clearing out these animals, I'm selling them for peanuts, and it's like I'm just going to get out of this business and I'm going to move to Wyoming or something. They're going to move to Dakotas. And it's like, so he wants to pick those up and then be able to turn around and have a little more patience and sell them for a much higher price, and it's like, you know, that's a way of doing business.
Now the thing I think they have a huge leg up on is Tim's wife Christy. Her dad has raised a lot of cattle. They both helped with the cattle over the years, and I mean, she knew things I would have no clue about. I grew up in the suburbs. I mean, we didn't have, you know, we didn't grow up around cattle, but you know, she knew that, you know, there's so many pine needles on their property that they have to really be careful that if they have a cow carrying a baby, that if it gets too many of the pine needles, it could throw the calf.
Right.
Is that right?
That's true. That's true. And so basically, if you've got enough other food, they won't try to eat the pine needles.
Right. So, I mean, they have a leg up because they know about that. And I know in the past they've always favored, you know, the grain-fed or the corn-fed, marbled meats. They love that. And what I've looked for myself personally is the grass-fed beef, because I hear from Michael Pollan how that is so much healthier, the omega fatty acids. It's good to have marbled meat, and it's, the fats can be good if it's grass-fed. And I know they're still pretty committed to that good grain-fed beef, because that's what they're used to, that's what they like. They like the taste of it. And the funny thing is, I've been buying a type of beef that is a certain breed that is supposed to be a low-fat breed, and the beef isn't very good. It's just not. I mean, the steaks, my son doesn't even want to eat the steaks. He thinks they taste like crap. So I think it's funny. But so I think there's, you know, I mean, there's some interesting things we've got going on there with raising beef and people buying beef because they want healthy meat. And I think there's still a little bit of, some people are looking for grass-fed, some people are looking for the fully marbled stuff. There's, you know, there's different breeds that are considered low-fat, others that are higher-fat. I know they do that with pork, and I know nothing about that with beef. So I think that's an area to really look at if you're looking at an income model and a market and what you want to go for.
Well, so I feel like I'm trying to talk about a lot of this stuff with them, and they're having, it's like drinking from the fire hose as I'm trying to convey this. And at one point, I mean, they had me come out to their property a few months ago, and I tried talking to them about hugel culture, and they were getting it. They were understanding it. Now this time I'm trying to say, okay, you know, let's talk about not just raising cattle, but having a variety of animals. Let's talk about maybe doing something where you're leasing some land from your neighbors, and part of the deal is going to be that you're going to improve the quality of their land. And so part of it's going to be hogs. Let's try and see if we can do things so that you can reduce your feed costs. Because a lot of times what it is you go out and you buy $3,000 worth of feed, and then you sell $3,000 worth of meat. And it's kind of like, wow, you've broken even there. Instead of, it's like your time and all the rest of the materials were free, or yet it, basically you ran into the negative. And so this is a huge, huge part of it. So I'm trying to talk to him about the idea of make sure, because like right now he's like, okay, I'm just, you know, he's in scramble mode trying to get this to get started and start working. And I said, make sure that the hay that you buy for the cattle that you have, for the 5 head of cattle that you have, make damn sure it does not contain any persistent herbicides. At this point in time, that's the number one thing, because otherwise what's going to happen is these cattle are going to eat that hay loaded with persistent herbicides. It's going to pass right through the animal, and then you're going to still have it for the next 5, 10, 15 years out there. And it might not be that stuff won't grow. It might just be that stuff is going to be a very stunted growth. And that's when Christy said something like, you know, only 4 out of 5 cow, or only 1 out of 5 cow pads actually gets to survive to adulthood before the dogs get a chance to eat it. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's still not going to work. You know,
right, it's going to pass through the dogs, too.
It's going to pass through the dogs, too, yeah. So, which you know, has a different set of problems to it. But anyway, the thing is it's like, okay, yeah, get started. You're bringing in organic matter. Yay, team. 5 acres is not enough for 5 cattle. And, of course, part of what he's thinking of is, like, moving up into the space of 50 head. And it's kind of like, all right, you want to be thinking, if you're going to have 50 head, you're going to be wanting to think about having, like, 150 acres or more.
Well, and they are. There's adjacent property, and they talked a lot about that. They're just getting to know their neighbors. They haven't been there that long, really. How long have they been there?
Since October, I think.
Yeah. So they're getting to know their neighbors. They're looking at land adjacent to them that's not being used that they might be able to lease or eventually buy. And so they're planning ahead. I mean, he has a day job. She's busy with the 3 kids, and you know, and they're looking at starting this on the side and eventually building it up so that they can. That's how they can you know, home fence.
Right. And I think this is, I mean, if you're going to raise cattle, then, yeah, you're going to need a lot of acreage, especially when you're getting started. I mean, once you've got something that's a really lush thing going on, then the game changes a bit. Because, like, right now, he's got such gravelly land that running the cattle out there in the spring isn't going to hurt it. But if you've got good soil, running the cattle out there in the spring is going to compact the soil. And so then you usually have a sacrifice area for that point of spring. Or you're going to say, you know what, I'm going to lease this other chunk of land over here, which is kind of gravelly now. And then as long as the cattle are out on that, then that's going to be a rich soil spot next year as all that manure breaks down. So it's a big area. I think that there's a lot of room for growth, and I do think that the first step is like, okay, let's start going after the organic market. Let's, instead of trying to compete with Safeway, let's try to compete with Whole Foods or that kind of thing. You know, rather than thinking about $2 a pound, let's start thinking about $10 a pound.
Right, right. And you were mentioning that the market area he's in, there could be a culture of people who don't like the word organic. They feel like it's just a fake word and that it might mean a bunch of false crap. And so he said, well, you know, maybe, I think you were recommending to him, you know, maybe not call it necessarily organic, but just know that, you know, it's raised a certain way, and certain people will be looking for that type of food.
I think you're going to find that there's going to be a lot of people that are gourmet. They're going to look for certain kinds of gourmet cuts. I think it's good to start thinking about how to get that beef to taste better based upon what the animal is eating more of. And then, of course, different breeds of beef that are going to have different kinds of flavors to it. I also think it's going to be good to kind of market, not necessarily to the organic, but to a field of, like, we have raised this meat in consideration of people who have chemical sensitivity. I think that would be a good way to market it, especially in that area. Because, yeah, when I was raising those hogs, some of my customers, their position was, when I started talking about, you know, organic or you know, lack of pesticides or something like that, their position was, I don't want to hear all your hippie voodoo talk. Just sell me the fucking pork.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and so, rather than not sell them that because they're dumb fucks, I kind of made more of a policy of, like, and I'm charging them more next time. but I think it really exposes something good. I mean, a lot of, because the area that he lives in is very conservative. And I think a lot of people that are into the conservative have been trained to think that organic means that you take perfectly good food, rub it in the dirt, and then sell it for twice as much.
Yeah, I've heard him say that before, I think. I think he uses that.
Yeah.
That phrase.
Because he thinks I'm stupid for buying only organic or eating only organic. And so that's his definition of organic. And, of course, they spend big gobs of time going and visiting the hospital and dealing with all kinds of ailments that, you know, I don't have to deal with. And I'm older.
Well, I went, you know, he did seem receptive, and this is just, you know, I don't know if it scales up to the, you know, trying to sell beef or trying to do what he wants to do, but the example I gave him that he seemed receptive to is, I know that organic eggs can sell for $4 or $5 a dozen, but that the forage chicken eggs can sell for $7 a dozen. $7 a dozen. And I mean, that's just one tiny example, and that's just eggs. And I imagine it can be similar for beef, pork, you know, the chicken meat, whatever. So,
right.
And people are now looking for that. People that are looking for flavor, people in the slow food movement, people that want local, for whatever reason they want local. A lot of that. Yeah.
I would think that I could raise eggs in such a way, along with a marketing program, that I could get $20 a dozen. And then there would be people out there that would say, we're having a special meal today or whatever. These eggs are not just any eggs, but these are Paul Wheaton's eggs. These are pampered poultry. These are like the food that the chickens eat is food that he would eat himself. And something like that. Some kind of scenario where it's like it's beyond even pastured stuff.
Right. Well, and there's our conversation this morning reminded me of something I read years ago that I might have mentioned in a podcast a long time ago, but there was a cranberry grower, and I had no idea that to grow cranberries the conventional way took so many fungicides and insecticides and all, you know, they grow them in bogs, and then they spray all this crap on them. And I read a story about a cranberry grower who decided to switch to organic just because he was excited at what he could get per pound for organic versus conventional. He's like, I want that. I want to get that price per pound. So he made the switch and switched over, and then he found out that when he used to spray the insecticides and fungicides and everything, his bog and the whole surrounding area would be silent for days. No birds, no frogs, no buzzing dragonflies. It would just be silent for days. And now that didn't happen. He didn't have to spray that junk, and he wasn't spraying that junk. And then the other times he would come home in a protective suit, all covered in the chemical stuff, but he had to put a protective suit on. And he'd come home, and his little daughter would want to hug him, and he'd have to say, no, don't touch me until I get the suit off. And he did it for the money at first, but then decided, wow, the upside were far more comprehensive than he would have imagined. He loved not feeling like he was killing wildlife. He loved that he didn't feel like he was exposing his daughter to toxic gick, you know, all of these other things. So I think, you know, anyway, that's just a sidebar. And that's what I was thinking about when we were talking about growing things this other way.
I guess the thing that made me think we need to make a podcast was that I was feeling a lot of frustration in trying to convey stuff, and it was such a big leap for him and so much new stuff. I mean, it really exposed a lot of the beginner stuff, like how do you get started, and I really think with permaculture, I mean, permaculture is a lot more work the first few years when you're getting things set up. But then if you're doing paddock shift systems with animals, then you do have a constant level of work. Although the work that you actually do, I think, is still a lot less. I mean, a lot of other places are still going to be feeding the animals, and whereas, you know, with paddock shift systems, the thing is that you let the animals feed themselves, but you move them around periodically.
Right, and that's the part that I think was like drinking from the fire hose, or was maybe a little bit out of their ken.
Because he was at my farm. He saw it happen. I said, do you remember that little pasture down there? And you were remarking on, like, wow, I remember when that was like pathetic. Like there was nothing growing there. And now look how crazy lush it is just before we move the critters in there.
Yeah.
And so he has seen it, and he's shocked, and he still doesn't quite get his head wrapped around it, but he's seen it.
Yeah, and he knows.
And so that's why he's asking me, like, okay, how do I set that up? How do I get that going?
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. And he was asking, okay, what feed? What do I, yeah. So, yeah, and they want more. And even Chris, he was saying, oh, yeah, email me some of the stuff. I just couldn't take it in because I was in the middle of cooking when you were talking about it, you know.
Yeah, I went up to their place and to give them advice, and I was supposed to go up there like a couple hours early to see Christy and look the place over and give suggestions, but, you know, instead she was cooking. She's like pointing out the window, see over there? And I'm kind of thinking, where's my laptop? I better get some work done.
But it's a lot easier if you're just saying, okay, do feed ABC and hay XYZ and rotate them in pastures. But a permaculture system is a lot more involved in that. It's looking for the hay that doesn't have the persistent herbicides. If you do have to supplement with hay, it's building the soils and building the system so that they have graze and browse. It's sometimes choosing breeds that like to browse. I mean, you guys talked about the
Scottish Highland, and so I was getting to be a big fan of Scottish Highland cattle, although I had not yet tasted the meat.
Wow.
But I also, on my farm, I had a lot of browse, and
yeah.
Scottish Highland cattle are more browsers than grazers,
right?
Which I think is going to make their meat taste a little bit stronger.
Well, yeah, that would be really interesting to check out, and I wonder what the fat content is like, whether it marbles up well.
See, my understanding is that Scottish Highland do not marble well, but they do have a lot of fat. But what they do is they have a lot of, I mean, they are winter cattle. They're those really woolly-looking cattle, and so they have a lot of fat on the outer layers, and then what happens is that they don't need as much food in the winter because they stay warm by themselves. And I know that Sepp Holzer has raised a fair bit of Scottish Highland, but I think that it's like, you know, the meat is going to taste so different that you might want to raise other more common breeds of cattle also to have a flavor of beef that's going to, I mean, I'm kind of thinking it might even be hard to call it beef, like whatever flavor, because of the flavor, but I've never even tasted it.
All right. Yeah, and he said he was looking into buying some, but they were freaky expensive. So, I mean,
yeah
I imagine the meat would fetch a high price too.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure exactly about that, but I do know that they're in demand enough that the animals themselves are going to fetch a high price. All right, so I think we've conveyed a lot here. It's important stuff about getting started and different kinds of markets, and also about long-term goals and the idea of, like, don't, like, a lot of people set their goals for, like, someday I hope I make $9,000 a year. Wouldn't that be great? And I think, while that's okay if people want to do that, I think it's also okay to say, someday I'm going to make $400,000 a year being a farmer. And I kind of think that a lot of folks, I think it's really easy to make, you know, very little, and it's much harder to make more. And I want to kind of talk to the people that are like totally okay with, like, yeah, I want to talk about making $400,000 a year. Because I do think that there's ways to do it that aren't that difficult. It's just work.
Right. Well, and this is a great example of, he's got a day job. He doesn't really have all the land he'd like to have, but they have enough land and they have enough that they're going to be innovative with to get started. And they already have a lot of knowledge about cattle to start with, which I'm impressed by, because I know nothing. That's why I talked about cranberries. You know, my excuse for that anyway.
Well, so I grew up, I spent some years growing up raising cattle. It was my uncle's place, and I was living with my granddad, and we had 500 to 1500 head, and on 500 acres, and it was, I mean, we a lot of it was hay. We just brought in mountains of hay, and we did some haying on our own, but yeah, this is all commodity stuff.
Right.
And not, as opposed to, like, what I'm talking about now is rather than trying to raise several hundred head of cattle, instead, and then you just take them to the feedlot thing and, you know, buy, and then you accept whatever price they're paying, like we talked about in a previous podcast.
Right.
I think that the thing to do would be to instead have something where you sell either slightly more direct, but whatever it is that you do, that you've got an eye on getting, like, 10 times more per pound than what they're paying for the commodity beef. I think that's the message. So, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about raising cattle, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.